Hey guys, this is The Conversation. It's episode 151 with Lauren Marinaro, director and partner at Foyer Messler Gallery in the Lower East Side. Very straight shooter, very on point and non-digressive, which I love, and a guest. We talk everything about the history of Zach Foyer's gallery, her dealings there, and she's very frank about the pros and cons of posting an ad in Art Forum magazine, something which I find a pretty contentious issue. And I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Zach Foyer's gallery over the years, up to its current incarnation, some of their artists, and some images from the flood from Hurricane Sandy that happened back in 2012. You can also, at The Conversation Pod, go to theconversationpod.com/survey, and we would be very grateful if you would take just a few minutes, fill out that survey. It gives us a sense of how to program the show in the future. So if you haven't filled that out, we would really appreciate it. 7, 8, and 9 are particularly important, but if you could go fill that out at all, that would be great. So before we get to conversation with Lauren, wanted to share with you the fact that recently I got a donation from an artist. And I'm grateful to all of you who listen and especially all of you who donate. But this artist is somebody who is, it was great to get both a donation and very kind feedback from. It's the artist Joanne Greenbaum, who is revered among artists and beyond. She's kind of revered in a not especially high-profile kind of way, and I love getting support from her and from people like that. So just wanted to put that out there. Thank you, Joanne. Thank you to all of you who have supported the show and continue to support the show. I really appreciate you guys. All right, let's get to that conversation with Lauren. I will talk to you more on the back end. If you can hang out to the way, way end, I've got a special announcement. So stay tuned for that, the tail end of the show. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you then. All right. So Lauren Marinaro, I can't not say your name. Would you like me to ask you a question about that, or do you want to just start jumping in with any of your past traumas from?
Are you going to reference tomato sauce? Is that what the?
That's up to you. I didn't say that.
No. Yes, I got that commonly with my last name.
Right. And you are Italian, I would imagine, at least on one side of your family.
Yes, I am on one side of my family.
Oh, and you're not on the other.
No, the other side, I'm Polish.
Ah, okay. Interesting. Got it.
Yeah.
But you like your name enough to not, you've never had to contemplate, maybe I'm going to go with the Polish version?
I used to hate it because it was like ethnic, you know, like Italian. I grew up on Long Island, so even on Long Island, I still didn't really like it. But now I like it because it's, you know, it's a different name, so at least kind of people remember it or know it, and there's not that many people with it.
Right.
Although I was telling someone last night, there's another Lauren Marinaro, who's a lawyer, who has a Twitter handle that's Sexy Sexy Chalupa, which is kind of embarrassing.
Right. Yeah, I have to say, I did the Lauren Marinaro search, and I did see a lawyer come up quite a bit. So those pesky lawyers and their SEO, you know.
I know, she has a top Google hit.
Right, right. But I'm sure you get plenty of traffic if people are looking for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think artists sometimes, things like that.
Yeah, exactly. You've been with here's a question, actually, before I even ask you or sort of set up your relationship to the gallery that you're with. Is it the Zach Feuer Gallery or is it Feuer Messler Gallery?
Now it's Foyer Messler, known as. So basically both when we merged, Zach Foyer closed and Untitled Gallery closed and formed a new entity, which is Foyer Messler.
Right.
So that's the company that I'm a partner in and that I work there now.
Okay. You're a partner with Foyer Messler.
Yes, exactly.
What about Messler-Foyer? So that's a whole nother set of people?
Yeah. No, actually, Messler-Foyer is the same thing. Mm-hmm. And at first, I mean, we basically, those were just kind of names for each space to, albeit confusing,
but
it was to identify the two different spaces that we had, which was the old untitled space, which was Messler-Foyer, and then our new space was Foyer Messler.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, our lease got pulled on the Messler-Foyer space. So right now we're only operating one space, but, you know, in the future, we still have, like, the name rights to that or and whatnot, websites, et cetera, to figure out how we'll use that branding.
I see. So right now you're down to the Foyer Messler space on Grand Street?
Exactly.
Okay. How is it from a gallerist standpoint and from the market standpoint and so on? First of all, I should clarify, is the Grand Street space technically in Soho or is it in the Lower East Side?
No, I think it's Lower East Side. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some might say Chinatown, but I don't really know now what the official Chinatown borders are. But according to the art world, it would be Lower East Side.
But it's basically close enough to the Lower East Side to be part of people's cycle of seeing galleries.
Yeah, we're like, it was nice because when we moved down there, basically a few months later, another building opened at 291 Grand, which is Gavin Brown and James Cohan, 47 Canal.
Ah, wow.
So
you're getting
nice.
Some
and
serious traffic.
Right there too.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just saying, so you're getting some pretty serious traffic, in other words.
Exactly. I mean, I definitely was nervous about that when we were moving from Chelsea because, you know, your ground floor space on 22nd Street, which was a good street. But I have to say I've been pleasantly surprised. One thing that's really nice is actually getting the pointed traffic. So when people come, they had to actually know where you were or know where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
So once they're there, they're much more engaged with the art, I felt.
Right.
That, you know, they're looking, they're asking questions. If they're collectors, they'll sit down for a minute because actually the setup of the gallery has more seating.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So that's been nice.
Yeah. You know, this brings to mind the question, which, I don't know if it's going to sound kind of hackish, but do you have a sense of the percentage of collectors that you sort of consistently work with that have come from just sort of traffic? I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, I guess that they all come from traffic at some point,
yeah.
but what, I guess what is the, maybe the question here is what is the rough ratio of people who sort of kind of discover the gallery organically, exactly, versus people you've cultivated over the years?
Yeah, I would say in general, that percentage is probably low.
Right.
People who literally just walk in off the street and didn't either call or email ahead of time or that I met at an art fair ahead of time and then came to the gallery.
Right.
So the amount, I will say when we used to be under the independent in the Dia space.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a little different because we would get traffic. So we weren't necessarily part of the independent. So it was kind of walk-in traffic. And I met some people that way.
Can you explain what the independent is? I'm actually not that clear on what that is.
Oh, yeah, sure. The independent is an art fair that Darren Fluke, who had a gallery in London, and Elizabeth D., who has obviously Elizabeth D. Gallery in New York, started.
Mm-hmm.
It's an invite-only art fair, so it's a curated art fair.
Mm-hmm.
And they started putting it on the upper floors of the DF building on 22nd Street. That building is now being changed over, so they moved this year to Tribeca, to a new space. But it continues where it's this kind of model of a curated art fair. They change it up each year and invite, you know, different galleries that either had interested, they think interesting program, or I think just galleries that they're interested in. And it's also designed in a different way. It's open. It's not booth style. There's kind of these floating walls.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's kind of an alternative version of an art fair.
I see. Got it. Okay. And then I wanted to also mention, as we were talking about your different spaces and your moving and whatnot, that there's Retrospective, which is a gallery that I assume Zach Foyer owns that's in Hudson. Do you have anything to do with that?
Yeah. So we recently just closed that about a month and a half ago.
Mm.
But that is actually that gallery Joel Messler and Zach were partners in. So that's basically how the whole merger kind of stems from that.
Right, right.
And Zach has had a house up in Hudson for years and decided that there, he wanted to open a space there and do it as kind of a non-representational model, which means that, you know, they can do projects with any artist, but no one was being represented. And also gave a chance to show artists that we wouldn't be able to necessarily show in New York, because either they had galleries in New York or maybe they were talking to a gallery, and also give a space where artists had a chance to do something outside of the box of what they had been doing, or just kind of get away for a period of time into the country and work outside of the normal like parameters of a New York exhibition.
Right.
So that for a little over 2 years, the beginning I was much more involved, where I was helping with a number of elements, and I was going up there a lot. But then basically as time went on, things got really hectic in New York, and it was hard for me to balance doing both of those. So I wasn't working as much with retrospective things.
Right.
But, you know, still, I was still kind of like obviously on the radar, and like I always knew what was happening and that kind of thing. But yeah, so basically I decided to close it. It's hard with a non-representational model, I think, long term, because you really want to be kind of dedicated to your artist and exposing their work to collectors and things like that. And then as a non-representational, you also don't necessarily want to use your artist's, I mean, your collector's resources when you're realizing on artists that you don't have a long-term relationship with.
Right, you know, right.
So that's like a balance.
Sure, that's a good point. And meanwhile, I'm not very aware of the details of it, but there's quite a number of galleries that have opened up in Hudson, right, in that area. And I wonder what your take is on the gallery scene there as far as it being viable, you know, as a new gallery district, or if it's more like these sort of in the country arms of, you know, the city galleries.
Yeah, I mean, there's two kind of elements to that. One is that upstate is increasingly becoming a haven for art world people. So there's a lot of people who and dealers who have houses up there, but also artists I know who have moved up there. Bard is in the center of it, so every summer there's an influx of artists at Bard, and then I know some people have stayed there. So there's definitely a growing arts community, which naturally, I think, stemming from that, that's why Zach opened up this gallery. You know, it's his community. He spends a lot of time upstate. Jack Shaman opened his space. Kristen Dodge just opened her space. So people who have houses up there in the community, I think, either doing projects in an area they like, they can get bigger spaces for cheaper prices. So it lets you be a bit more experimental in that vein.
Right, right.
But the other thing is that it depends what you're showing. So a lot of the artists that were shown at Retrospective were people who were kind of people collectors knew about or had seen online. So work was, there's interest in people not necessarily seeing the shows, but are looking at it online and then contacting the gallery with interest about the work.
Right.
Because it's something that they have seen previously.
Right. Okay, so now we've sort of covered the foundation of the gallery and some of its moving around and settling. But to get to you, you are the director of the gallery and also, as it turns out, even though it doesn't say this currently on your staff page or your contact page, you're also a partner. So you're a partner of Foyer Messler?
Yes.
Okay. And what does that entail exactly?
I mean, if this is another thing about partners at smaller galleries, is a more complex than in the sense that there's no real precedent necessarily. So when I was having discussions with Zach and Joel about this, it was, you know, there wasn't many people that you could talk to. It's definitely not set up like Zwerner or Gagosian has partners, but that's a much different scenario. So basically, I mean, I'm a partner in the company, so I have a financial stake in what happens, and which for me is good in a lot of ways. It gives me a say, and also, I mean, I was very dedicated to the gallery before that, but even more so now, I would say, if that's possible.
Right. So you have, your consequences are greater for both upside and downside, in other words.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right, right. This has just been like the last 6, 7, 8 months, something like that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
So since you became partner, have you noticed that your working approach has changed, or is it more more of a concept kind of thing that drives maybe your decisions?
I mean, I wouldn't say approach in the sense of day to day. You know, I still interact with the staff in similar ways and the artists. But I think I'm just really pushed and driven to, you know, push our artists to kind of the next level and help them with exposure. And I've done a lot more studio visits. Just, I mean, I think, not that I didn't before, but just that I feel very engaged and re-engaged with what I'm doing and excited by that. But yeah, I would say that generally my approach is probably fairly similar, but just kind of I didn't realize that I didn't have the same like overarching view of like what's going to happen in 5 years, what's going to happen in 10 years. And I think now, you know, I think about that in a much different way.
Mm. When you mentioned doing studio visits, is that what percentage of that is people who are part of the gallery? Is it like 90%?
No, I think, that's a good one. I don't know the exact percentage, but I do definitely do studio visits with people who aren't part of the gallery, whether they be friends or artists that I'm interested in or artists that I've seen work. And then, yeah, I mean, maybe 50-50, I would say.
Wow. Okay. So this is kind of giving me a flashback to a segment of the conversation that I had with Michelle Grabner, you know, as she was heading up towards her curating the biennial, like, what for the artist, you know, what are they expecting, you know, getting a studio visit from you? If it's a friend of yours, obviously it can be pretty casual, but if it's say somebody you're just meeting or what have you, you know, I mean, they're sitting there going, oh my god, are they going to show me, are they going to be part of the gallery, right? So what to what extent are you calming them down as far as their anticipation, their anxiety?
Yeah, I mean, that's a complicated issue. And I imagine much like when they're doing Whitney biennial visits and artists are, you know, really hoping that they get included in the biennial.
Yeah.
But it was something that I used to feel when I was like younger or even maybe less experienced, more pressure about like, oh, what are they thinking? Like what? I don't want to like hurt their feelings or I don't want to, you know, and then even maybe hesitant sometimes to do a studio visit because of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now I realize that I think that an important element of when artists are navigating their career is to understand that you're going to have a lot of studio visits and some are going to be great and some aren't going to be great and some are going to end up in something that might be fruitful and others won't. But from my point of view, I just go in and I hope to have a really nice conversation and understand the work better. And I don't really put that pressure on myself either to make a decision. Sometimes you are in the studio and they're like, this is amazing. I want to show this. But sometimes I want to think about it afterwards as well and think like, how would this go with the program? What would this, with the context of this? And what is our exhibition schedule coming up? And that kind of thing.
Right. When we spoke earlier, you mentioned that you have been with the gallery 8 years. Do I remember that right?
Yes.
And so when you started, what was your position?
Temporary fill gallery assistant.
Wow. Okay. So kind of pretty much the bottom of the totem pole.
Yeah.
Right. And how did you hook up with that job?
Well, it was listed on NYFA.
Okay.
And so I was applying for, I'd moved back from London, where I went to grad school, and I was applying for jobs. Lots of them, and interviewing. And then this job was posted, and, you know, they said, we have someone coming in September, but between May and September, they needed a second person to just kind of be doing work there and monitoring the gallery because they also had an art fair coming up, so they weren't even going to have anyone. They needed someone to kind of be there physically.
Right.
And actually that's when the crash happened, which kind of, when you say like low person on the total halt pole, and this situation, it kind of worked out because, you know, I was like the bottom person getting paid the least.
Right.
So just.
So you got to stay around.
Or what was happening. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking as you were describing, I was realizing that, oh yeah, that was 8 years ago, was just 2008. So that was right around. And so there you were. So you were there, what, like a few months or so? And then, you know, the crash started to kind of start its impact?
Yeah, so I started in May, and Lehman Brothers collapsed in September.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the date, but whatever, that day in September.
Sure.
And 2008 ended up not being that I don't think it was that terrible, but 2009 was a slow year for the art world.
That's when things kicked in, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. But before we move on to your arc at the gallery, so what did you go to graduate school for in London?
I did the Sotheby's program in contemporary art.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I like that. I had looked at programs here in the U.S. I'd gone to Goldsmiths for a year for undergraduate, so I did want to go back to London.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that program because it started at 1940 instead of like late 19th century, which a number of art history or modern art history programs start at.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I knew that I was particularly interested in contemporary art. So
contemporary
it appealed
art.
To me.
Yeah, got it. And was your thinking that this would, did you have a strong pull towards a particular part of the art world? I mean, are a lot of people in that program going to go into galleries, or is it kind of a mix of galleries, auction houses, you know, consultants and so on?
Yeah. Well, I knew I definitely wanted to work at a gallery. I knew that. I didn't want to work in an auction house. I didn't want to work at a museum.
Right.
I didn't want to work kind of nonprofit. I wanted to work at a gallery.
Right.
That program is interesting. Actually, a large majority of the people in the program don't even work in the art world.
Mm.
But there are people, I know a number of people who do work as art advisors, or there are a few people at galleries. A good friend of mine is the director at Postmasters from Sotheby's program.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some gallery people.
So what does the Sotheby's program give you and your colleagues that makes you appealing to a gallery, say, for example, since those were the examples you used? I mean, how much of that is reputation versus the things that they actually teach you or expose you to?
Right. So in terms of like practical everyday, like this is how you, at that time, it still was when they were doing like 8x10s instead of, there was no iPad even at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like this is how you do like specific tasks in the art world. But what I found was really useful was just a blast of knowledge and names of contemporary artists.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
I find that that's the way to connect with people when you're at the gallery. So collectors come in and say, what shows are up, you know, or artists come in and say, what shows are up, what's good. And you start having a conversation about art. That's a lot of, you know, what the context is when you're in the art world, that people do talk about it.
Right. Right.
And when you can carry on that conversation, I think it's a strong advocate for yourself, because it shows that you're interested in the art world and that you have a working knowledge of the artists that are in it and who's important.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can then, you know, do the basic tasks that are required at a gallery and that kind of thing, that, you know, you build upon that. But for me, I think just the knowledge base is really great.
Right. What do you think think your approach in particular and generally over the years at the gallery has been in terms of, you know, speaking of what you were just talking about, like with talking about art, in terms of the conversations you have with people coming in, whether they be people you know casually or collectors or what have you? And to just give you a little sort of context of where I'm coming from, you know, I'm thinking of some mm-hmm. some galleries will be very, I don't know if aggressive is the right word, but maybe a little overly proactive,
uh-huh.
you know, in sort of telling people, and these can be good galleries too, or these can be smart people at good galleries.
Yeah.
But I, you know, so I just have just had such a range of experiences, you know, from the sort of really cool corporate gallery kind of thing where they kind of ignore you, you know, aggressively ignore you, to, you know, the kind of thing mm-hmm. where they talk your ear off about what's going on. It's like, okay, I don't, this was something that Jerry Saltz actually referenced, you know, because he obviously gets approached like crazy, but it's like, I don't need your press release. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I definitely am not of that. Like, if Jerry Saltz comes in, he can walk around, I'll say hi, and if he has a question, I'm happy to answer. But I definitely would not get up and
right.
try to walk him through the show unless he asked me to.
Right.
Because he knows enough about art, and he knows enough about something to walk through. Like you said, there are people who will do that.
Yeah.
That's not, like, my necessary style. But then there's collectors, and, you know, a number of collectors, as the years pass on, you see these people at art fairs and events, and you have dinners with them, and they do become your friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a number of collectors who, when they walk in, I'll just, you know, walk around the show with him. We, you know, we might mention the art, but we're just also catching up. So, and then those are the type of people who are often like, what's up? You know, I haven't been down on the Lower East Side lately. What shows are good? What have you seen? And that's kind of where that stems from.
Right.
But I also, and in terms of like strangers, it depends. Like if people ask questions, I'm willing to answer them and have a conversation with them. Sometimes it's frustrating because, you know, people do come in, and I'm shocked now because even on the second floor, we get people who I just don't know how they find galleries with the type of questions they ask, you know,
yeah.
Like they'll walk in and be like, do I have to pay? And then they start asking.
How often do you get that question? Yeah. That is fantastic.
Yeah. And you're like, how did you find this? And now you're asking if you have to pay. Or like, why don't the artists sign the paintings on the front? You know, these kind of questions. And
wow.
If I'm there, obviously I'll answer. But like at this point, I feel like I sat at a front desk for long enough that now I've passed on the baton to my colleague who handles a lot of these questions.
Did you get that when you were that person, you know, seven, eight years ago, did you get that kind of traffic?
Oh yeah. It's way worse in Chelsea because tourists read books and they see, oh, I can just walk through Chelsea, and on the ground floor, they just walk through like a shopping mall.
Right.
So they come in and it's almost like they want an education on art from you, which I get, you know, like, and Jerry Saltz also says like, you know, galleries are offering this free service, but sometimes it would get frustrating, but it's like, where's the bathroom? How do you get to the High Line? Is there, you know, and you start becoming like a tourist, liaison,
right?
And then also asking these crazy questions about art and the art world.
Yeah.
Oh, and actually talking to someone about this the other day, really sometimes offensive things like, what do you do all day? You just play on your computer all day?
You know, this is kind of dovetailing a little bit with a part of a conversation I had in the last episode. And it's in the bigger picture, it's kind of an ongoing theme, which is that of, on one hand, you know, the segment of the art world, or just of contemporary art, maybe is a better way to put it, who is really naive, you know, and uneducated, and frankly sometimes a bit annoying or pesky, you know. But on the other hand, the other side of the conversation is, well, the art world is so elitist, you know. So it's kind of like part of you, part of me is saying, I can't believe these people come in and go, why aren't there signatures on the front? You know, it's just like, you know, it's a galling question to ask. On the other hand, it's kind of like, well, if you sort of lash out with a reaction that says, you know, where are you coming from? Where did you get this idea?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You're kind of like, well, then are you perpetuating, you know, sort of an elitist kind of, you know, it's kind of complicated to wrangle out those, you know, that dichotomy in a way.
Yeah. And I guess I should specify, there's two ways to ask that question. There's one, like, why didn't the artist sign this? You know, out of pure curiosity.
Sure.
And there's another and that's one type of person who did come in. And I would be happy. I would spend time with these people and like try to explain them like, oh, well, you know, an artist finds a gallery, like we do studio visits. It is kind of a network. So they went to the art school, you know, and we'd have a conversation. But there's other people who come in and be quite aggressive.
Right.
And that would shock me. I guess that was more what I'm talking about. So people who are like, why doesn't the artist sign this on the front? You know, this is an art. What is this? I can't believe you're showing this, you know? And it's like, that's when you're really like, well, you know, you don't have to like everything, because I certainly don't.
Right.
But if you're, you know, you've entered a space that's free to enter and we're putting art on the walls for you to look at, you cannot like it. I'm happy to have that discussion, but there's people who come in and are very aggressive.
Yeah. That's really infuriating, actually. I mean, I think it's kind of like, you know, despite being sort of on guard about, you know, we don't want to, not just you, I'm talking about in general, that galleries wouldn't want to project an air of elitism, like, you know, you don't belong here, get out kind of thing. You know, like Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman kind of comes to mind as sort of an ridiculous cliche of that. But on the other hand, you know, hearing your description of this kind of scenario, it makes me think, you know, what these people really should and it seems should be required to be doing is do a little homework. You know, I'm not sure what the analog is, you know, in another field or in another sort of cultural situation, but it's like, I mean, I for some reason, one thing that comes to mind, which I'm guilty of, is, you know, I have seldom gone to classical music concerts, but I went to one.
Right.
I went to one at the Disney Hall, you know, Frank Gehry's fancy Disney Hall downtown, you know, just to sort of be inside that building. And I was not aware of the movement situation, you know, where you are supposed to and not supposed to clap, you know, and you would see these people near you who are like kind of giving scolding looks at people who are clapping at the wrong time. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, is that a fair analogy? It just seems like people shouldn't just ramble into galleries and be really aggressive. I think we can say that.
That's my thought part. I'm happy for people who don't have exposure to come in and look. And I've had some really amazing, sweet experiences with people who have said, I'm like, wow, this is so neat. I've never, you know, and they're such on a basic level, but it's really amazing to see it through someone who has no view eyes, and they're appreciative, and they're like, they're having that kind of experience with the show.
Right.
It gets frustrating when people get aggressive. It's like, I'm busy, so if I'm giving you up my time, and then you're trying to be argumentative, that's when sometimes it would get frustrating.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have to say, that's one thing about being on the second floor. It's been much, much less than when we were on ground floor at Chelsea.
Right. And what would you say the typical scenario, how that would play out, I should say, when it's a really one of the heavyweight galleries? I imagine, I'm just going to guess, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but you've got basically everybody is sort of, most of the staff, rather, is kind of up on the second floor or cordon off, you know, in the behind the Velvet Rope offices. And then you've got this one, you've got this one young gallerist, you know, or gallery assistant, rather, at the front desk. And they basically are the front line for all those kinds of experiences.
Yes. I know, like, Gagosian, for example, heavily trains their front desk people from everything of how the intonation of how to answer the phone.
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, I'm sure that they prep them for those, like, if it's a salesperson, this is who you contact. Obviously, we accept no submissions, like, things like that, and the hard line. I don't know if they are even, like, they probably are told kind of how the even demeanor they should handle those kind of requests in.
Right,
For the most part. And, yeah, and I think they probably at the big galleries do have a line. Like I tell, you know, whenever we would have someone new start or something at our front desk, I say, you know, we don't accept submissions. We actually made a sheet, which has really started making it easier in terms of like dealing the blow. If you're saying like, no, I'm sorry, we don't accept submissions, but we have this sheet for some ideas for you.
Oh.
And I find that people have been really appreciative and it changes the tone.
That's very generous. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was actually Zach's idea and Zach kind of put things together, but it really changed the way that those interactions went, which has been nice. But yeah, I know, I mean, I have a lot of friends who work at other Lower East Side galleries that we don't have protected offices, most of us, you know?
Right.
So we get that kind of thing where people saying, you know, do you accept submissions? And you have to have that conversation.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny because I have seen it though, even at Gagosian, which is shocking because you're like, you think like, just because in our world, that's like the biggest gallery. And then you realize that they get the same exact question.
Do you have friends who work at Gagosian, by the way?
No, I mean, I know people like socially, but I don't have, none of my really good friends work there.
Okay. I was just trying to get some dirt. That's all. yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's just, I can kind of empathize with people of a certain age, especially who would not know that, you know, how it works with submissions. But I think maybe really the art education system, you know, is largely to blame for that. And there are only, you know, there's probably less than a handful of institutions, whether they're art schools or universities or grad schools, where they actually teach that kind of thing, I would imagine. In the States, anyway?
That's a huge thing.
Yeah.
I think also for art history, I think the same art history and studio art, they should have, I think, at least, you know, just one class or even a lecture about how to handle your career because so many people don't know.
Right.
And everything from percentages to, you know, just the basics even, I think would be so helpful.
So you were coming into the gallery as the crash started and then kind of took effect. And you got to stay on because, you know, because you weren't costing the gallery that much. And would you say, what would you say about, you know, learning the business and whatnot and also having, you know, the sort of the market play out? I mean, I'm going to basically make the assumption that my understanding of the high art gallery world, there was a slowdown, you know, over a year or two, but then basically much faster than the rest of the economy, things kind of went back to normal. And then even now, you know, kind of rose again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm can't be more thankful for working at actually like a mid-level gallery where you kind of get full exposure to everything that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So in a short amount of time, I got a lot of knowledge about different elements of how the business worked. In this time, also the bookkeeper left, so I started doing all the bookkeeping. So really getting a sense of like costs and mm-hmm. And that kind of thing of how a small business, but specifically a gallery, is run. But what you said is absolutely correct. So 2009 was slow, but by 2010, things were back, and there was always people who knew that in 2009 they could kind of get a deal or they didn't have as much competition for getting quality work. But the artists that were hot were still hot in 2009. You know, at that time we were showing Dana Shuss, and people wanted Dana Shuss, and everything we got would sell because she's an amazing artist. And that, despite the fact that, yes, the economy is down, these are people with considerable wealth and collect a luxury product that
mm-hmm.
have a desire in that period to obtain.
Right. Right.
You might have in certain sectors of your program, harder time selling, more challenging work, but the things that were mainstays, really people still were coming to.
Right. Well, you inadvertently, Lauren, set up one of my most sensitive, if not most sensitive, questions, which I have to put on the table now, and that is, so you mentioned Dana Shuss and, you know, how she was selling like crazy, but she left the gallery, what was it, in like 2012 or something like that? What was the story there?
So, I mean, I think at that point that Dana wanted to kind of go to a bigger gallery,
mm-hmm.
which she went to Petzl, who are in fact a bigger gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that happens with, you know, it's as their career grows, they want different things or a gallery who can maybe support them in a different way. It's obviously always hard for a gallery when an artist leaves, and it's upsetting, but in some ways it also means that you're doing your job well, because
right.
In the case of Dana Shuss and, you know, a few other examples, when the gallery, the artists are going on to a bigger gallery and showing proven much more, increasing success as their career builds, it shows that you, you know, created a good foundation and had a good eye, as Zach did with Dana.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of a natural, I think, thing where there's going to be limitations for certain sizes of galleries, whether it be monetary or just the, you know, manpower or resources that a larger gallery is going to be able to offer an artist as their career grows.
Right. Yeah. And you, when you mentioned just a little bit earlier, the sort of, you made reference to the mid-sized gallery, and that's something that I've occasionally talked about here, which is a really interesting place to be, you know, because Nicole Klagsbrun, the gallerist who I spoke with like a couple years ago,
yeah.
You know, she was like a classic mid-sized gallery, and she, one of her big complaints was the mollification, or whatever the expression was, you know, the giantizing of the gallery scene, you know, with these huge mm-hmm. galleries, you know. It was like, how does a mid-sized gallery survive? And Foyer seems to really be flourishing kind of in that really small niche, because it's like, on one hand, you've mm-hmm. got a larger gallery, you know, poaching your artists on one hand, and then, you know, below you, you have the emerging or really young galleries where the overhead is not as much of an issue. So it's like, how does the mid-sized gallery? And so, but just to set it up a little bit further, it seems like you know, those are obviously the cons or the challenges of being a mid-sized gallery, you know, is that you're vulnerable to that kind of scenario. But it, I guess, and you can obviously spell it out a lot more clearly, but I guess the nice thing about being a mid-sized gallery is that it is more of a family, I would imagine, to maybe use a little bit of a cliche, but also, you know, that you don't have to get turn into this sort of cold corporate sort of structure.
Yeah, and that's how I feel. I like that not only do I continually have conversations with all of our artists, but all of the staff, and I love our staff right now, and I also like that they get opportunities of exposure to the artists. So the artists know, you know, Claire and Jennifer, my two coworkers, and they know who they can contact, and they know that everyone kind of knows what's going on to a level, so it's not just like when we're saying like a front desk person at a big gallery is not going to know, you know, really anything, and not to like diminish what they're doing, but they're not going to know the ins and outs of if their sales or if where the works are located or what is shipping. Whereas if Jennifer and Claire might not know everything, they definitely have some kind of inkling, or they could say, oh, Lauren knows that. We'll work on it. So I like that. I definitely like that. And I think that there are benefits for artists at that level because then they have kind of a team and we all know what's going on with everyone.
Right.
But yeah, and there's a number of things that are, it's hard. Like, I think just some artists, you're never going to make a very, like, specific idea in their head of what it means to be success. So if that means art forum ad, and that's one of the things I kind of have increasingly have and brought this up in discussions with other people. When you talk about a mega gallery, buying an art forum ad is really not much for them. For us, it's a pretty major cost. Art forum ads are expensive. So if an artist is like, I really want one, that it has to be a choice that you're like, okay, well, then we might not be able to do this because of this. Or, you know, there's different, like, decisions to be made in that realm. But it's hard when you're trying, when you're growing the gallery, because these are the decisions you're making at the same time trying to maintain a mid-level where you're putting on really quality programming and your artists are having amazing shows and they're having museum connections, and to balance all of that out. And then at the same time, you're almost a stepping stone. So artists are leaving at some point, and then you're taking, you know, like obviously the emerging galleries, like you said, with the lower overhead, we might take an artist from there or someone who's had one show before. But it's kind of this continual process of artists and managing all of that.
Right.
I mean, I still feel like I'm learning what is a mid-sized gallery, you know?
Right. So you said a minute ago that artists have asked you for art formats. Is that true?
Yeah.
So it's you guys, it's never you guys saying we should get an art format for these people. It's the artists asking for it. So this is their way of, I'm not going to put words into your mouth. Why are artists asking for art formats?
Well, that is what my question was. And it was, I understand when I was trying to have this with a few friends and kind of colleagues, I understand the past of the art format, like how, and to this day, you know, I do get art form and I flip through and I look at the ads. That's basically, and it's funny because
you
when
are
I was
guilty.
Younger in college, I would read the articles.
You are
and
guilty.
Now I look at the ads.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that before social media and all that, that was kind of, you know, you look at this and it still is. There's all the big galleries in there with their artists. But I think that the landscape has changed. So I don't know if it's artists thinking like this is the establishment. And I think this is probably part of the art format is like really making it. But I think there's a lot of alternatives to the art format at this point in time where, you know, people have large followings on social media and other ways of announcing their shows that are perhaps like more contemporary.
Right. You know, it's one thing to be on the cover of Art Forum, which obviously is very rare and very, very hard to control. But having an ad, I mean, there's this, as you were talking about that before, or as you brought up the subject of the Art Forum ad, there's this gallery here in Los Angeles, which will go unnamed, you know, when you go up to their desk and, you know, they've got the list of works and the bio and all that, if, as is often the case, the show has been advertised, you know, they'll have the art forum there as well, and they'll have a post-it, you know, with that page where that ad is. And it's just, to me, that's just so lame. you know?
Yeah, and, so weird.
Yeah.
That's
and,
really weird.
And I kind of get, you know, thinking of it from an artist perspective, it's like, well, I can't buy my way under the cover, but I can buy my way into the magazine. You know what I mean? So people
right.
are going to, it's going to be great exposure, you know, because people are going to be flipping like Lauren Marinaro is through the magazine,
yeah.
right? And they're going to see my ad and they're going to go, oh, and they're going to be on your radar. So I get that. But just, you know, and maybe as a business person slash artist, maybe that's a really good business move. And that's, I guess, what I'm trying to wrap my head around. But from a sort of gut intuitive level, it feels really lame.
Yeah. I mean, I find it to be also the irony is kind of this when you're saying like putting someone on your radar. Most of the galleries, if they're going to do an art forum ad for an artist, it's going to be someone who could pay back on that ad. It's not going to be like the young artist that they've never shown before and no one knows their name.
Right.
It's more like the gallery attaching themselves to this artist. If it's someone like perhaps like their first show or with them or announcing that they're going to have this big show that's coming up that people probably would know about anyway.
Right.
So it's just like more about the top end of it. It's not this nobody artist, not nobody, but you know, someone that no one knows about.
Right. Right. So basically you're very clinically pointing out that it's not a good business move. Am I correct?
Well, I'm not saying it's not a good business move, but I have a hard time right now justifying at the gap. Like if you have unlimited funds as like maybe some of these mega galleries do, it's a much different drop in the bucket
right.
to spend, you know, $5,000 or $7,000 on this ad
right.
as opposed to a mid-level gallery that can maybe put different resources into doing a show that's experimental and then you don't have to worry about selling the work because you just want to put on a good show.
Right. Yeah, it's good that you mentioned that number. So it's probably, from your knowledge, in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $7,000 for a full page ad, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I've long been concerned with, and it comes up occasionally, the power that is being perpetuated into that magazine, you know,
mm-hmm.
if only through the ads. And but it kind of makes me hopeful, and I have to ask you if it kind of, on some level at least, makes you hopeful as well that through social media, it's shifting the landscape. And there's going to come a point, you know, maybe not for another 15 years or something tremendously long like that, where, you know, people aren't going to be paying big sums and they're not going to be dominating the landscape the way they are now and have been.
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting because you see even with like not just the post-internet artists, but, you know, we obviously work with a number of artists who have been considered that, not that they like that term, but even like Brad Trammell is very adept at using both social media to both show his work and almost be part of his work. The social media is an extension of his practice. And that's how a lot of people know about him. So it's interesting in that sense as well, that you don't necessarily need, there is alternative, which is basically what you're saying as well, alternative structures to putting yourself out into the art world and for other people to know about you.
Sure. Right. Well, do you feel like we've exhausted the art form part of the conversation?
Yeah.
I mean, I could talk about this for a long time just because it's just such an obvious focus of concentration is the word I was looking for, of power into one institution. And it's to the point where it's really top heavy. It's like the Leaning Tower of Pisa of power, you know? And so I just,
right.
I can't sort of question it enough.
Yeah.
And I may very well take this out, but just for what it's worth, so I can tell you, I was having a conversation with an LA gallerist, a fairly young, not quite mid-level, even probably emerging, about a year ago. And I was talking about the process of beginning to look for sponsors for the podcast. And I was talking about galleries, and she was saying, no gallery is going to advertise on your podcast. They all want to advertise in art form. They're all going to go there. If they advertise anywhere, they're going to advertise on art form. So anyway, so you can see I have a bit of a personal stake in it.
Yeah, I think that's a really odd response to say to you, because I don't think that's even true. Like,
mm-hmm.
I went to the Bomb magazine benefit this year,
mm-hmm.
and it was really amazing to see the type of people that support Bomb, because it's a totally different type of magazine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And people who want to advertise in that and be branded with it, maybe?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But exactly.
my interest in it really lately has been the psychology of why artists want art formats,
right,
if they do, or what that is about.
Right. Yeah. And it's still evolving. It's evolving, like what's going on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. I think it's definitely. And it's moving quicker since social media and all the different types and the internet.
I think it's definitely evolving. I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the gallery and Hurricane Sandy. Because you guys were on the front lines of Hurricane Sandy in, forgive me, what year was that? 2013?
2012.
Okay.
October 29th, 2012.
Got it. Right. So why don't you, just however you like, give your arc of the story of what happened there.
Well, we had heard there was going to be a storm coming, and mm-hmm. we knew that we were in a flood area.
Mm-hmm.
To say that this is unprecedented is an understatement. Nothing like that had happened in the area for, so we left on Saturday evening and put all of the work we had at the gallery on blocks, basically 4x4s,
mm-hmm.
Thinking that if there was any moisture that got in the gallery, that would be fine. The reports started getting more intense on Sunday, and CRG was next to us at a time, the gallery, and they went in and put everything on 4-foot tables. So they lifted everything up on 4-foot tables, which we did not do because we were like, well, it was like at that point, I don't really think, I don't know. We had a lot of storage on site. And we just, we had put, I think we had put sandbags because our landlord came by and said, oh, here's some sandbags or something.
Was there part of you or your colleagues that were like, I wonder if we should do that too? Or was more like, we can only do as much as we can do. And, this is as much space as we can afford to move things around.
Well, I think it wasn't even like that. It was more like, if this is going to be such a big storm that we have to have the work 4 feet off the ground, then that's actually not even good enough.
Right.
So that's not going to do anything if mm-hmm. we move this work higher in the gallery. Basically, and after we realized we would have had to move everything off site for it to have been safe. And that wasn't even on the radar, like to think of like emptying the whole gallery under 8 feet,
mm-hmm.
because that would have been a lot of man hours, a lot of expense, but also it just seemed ridiculous. Like, there was not, we thought at most you get a couple inches, and
right.
we were okay with that because everything was like up, our whole storage was up higher than that.
Right.
But as it turns out, Sunday night came and was terrible, and we got, 7 feet of water in the gallery.
Wow.
It knocked down, afterward, and like CRG, it knocked down everything they had lifted up 4 feet. It knocked off the tables. It knocked the wall down the wall between the two galleries. So, that hadn't even done it. It was so beyond what anyone thought it would be. And yeah, it was really sad. There was, everything was destroyed, files. And that's what a lot of people have also talked about, like this archive kind of material that cannot be replaced, that got damaged, that was in filing cabinets. And we lost over 700 pieces of artwork and the
wow.
computers and mm-hmm. our server was up high, but it got an inch of water got in the bottom of it. Luckily, we had offsite storage, but I know people who didn't and lost everything they had on computers.
Wow.
So
were you, just to backtrack for a second, when you were you on the part of the group that went to see the damage, like the next day, or how soon did you go down there?
Yeah. So, yeah, and I actually drove a bunch of people because I had a car and everything was shut. I don't know, every public transportation was shut, and actually all the bridges were shut.
Mm.
So I had picked everyone up in Brooklyn, and then we were trying to get into Manhattan
mm-hmm.
on Monday,
mm-hmm.
and they kept turning us away from every bridge.
Mm.
And finally we got up to the 59th Street Bridge, and they had just opened it.
Right.
But all the traffic lights were out because the electricity was out, and
mm-hmm,
it was mm-hmm. really crazy. But yeah, so it was me and my colleague, and I think we picked up two art handlers that day too, and we all went to see what happened. I mean, the doors had been pushed shut, and then the water made them swell, so we couldn't open some of the doors.
Wow.
And we had to wait.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. And I think so that Monday, we suss everything out, but I don't think we couldn't really do much because we had to wait till we had some people there to help us open doors. And then our landlord was incredible and was there with generators and fans, and they started ripping out sheetrock right away so that it wouldn't mold.
Right. And was Zach on hand as well with you?
Yeah. Zach came. He had gone upstate for the day, and then he was down right away.
Right.
And we were all there. There's a picture of him in the New York Times, actually.
I think I saw that picture. That's what I'm thinking of, yeah. Actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was the insurance situation?
We this is crazy, too. So Zach was like, can you pull up the policy? And I was like, yeah, sure. And I wasn't even thinking. Randomly, that August, Zach had been like, maybe we should just up our insurance. And it had nothing to do with anything. I found this email from him. It was super random, out of the blue.
Right.
So we were well covered. It was like the most weird, miraculous thing.
Wow.
So we were well covered. Our insurance company was great.
Wow. So you were completely financially covered for the loss.
Yes.
That's phenomenal. We That's awesome.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, what was the feedback from the artists whose works were lost?
Oh, the artists were really amazing. Everyone was amazing because, well, one, they got paid on the work because of the insurance company. So,
right.
You know, as sad as it is that some work is lost, they were, you know, getting at least monetary compensation at a time that they probably wouldn't have.
Right. So they were actually pretty lucky in that sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they were understanding. They were, you know, super understanding of obviously us getting back up and running. And
right.
There was nothing we could have done. It wasn't, there was no fault of anyone. It was
sure.
just obviously crazy natural disaster. And yeah, we had good insurance, so that felt like we could help the artists in that way. We had, our other storage was all up high in Chelsea, so that was all safe.
Right.
Yeah,
I should be a little bit more explicit of the context that I asked that question, because I had a long time ago, I had the artist Robin O'Neill on this show, and through email, I heard from her probably most labor intensive piece ever, which was called Hell, was in the Susan Englert Gallery, I think it is. And it was completely destroyed. And it's a paperwork, you know. And I guess she had put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and time into that piece. So she was – and there was no financial compensation. So between those two things, you know. So in that sense, I could see how it was a very different situation for your artists.
Yeah, I mean, that's devastating either way. Even if she did get financial compensation, it's something, you know, that you labored on. I can imagine that just being devastating. But yeah, that's upsetting that if there wasn't any coverage on the works in the gallery, which, you know, hopefully from that, most galleries now understand, like, how important it is to, one, have offsite backup computer-wise, and two, insurance.
Right. And you still have that same policy with that same insurance company?
Yeah, we do.
Right. Of course, great. You're much more landlocked now, right?
Yeah, and we're on the second floor. So unless, you know, bar it being someone's, like, plumbing going wrong.
Right.
Safe from water, hopefully.
Yeah. Right. Well, I don't have a particular direction at the moment. I guess I'd want to ask maybe what are your thoughts about the evolution of the gallery since you've been there? I mean, apart from your own evolution, you know, and sort of learning the business as you've gone, how has the gallery changed, evolved in notable ways, would you say?
Yeah. Well, we've moved a number of times, so that has been exciting. We were in 24th Street when I first started, and then we moved to the large space on 22nd Street. And I guess I would say the most significant thing has been recently with moving down to Laurie Side. So our space is smaller than it was, and merging with Untitled. But in a lot of ways, I'm pretty excited about this new chapter because the art world has changed really quite drastically, I would say, in the past few years in terms of the number of galleries, which there always are more galleries. This is a common thing to say, but artists run spaces and expansion into Brooklyn. And Instagram cannot be, you know, I think there's no word that's like the impact of Instagram, I guess, is what it's really changed a lot about how we look at art and how people acknowledge art and how collectors interact and how artists interact. And it's changed a lot about how things are done. So I think just in this age of that, the Instagram kind of era of the art world, and now we're in this new community on the Lower East Side, which is really quite buzzing. And that's been exciting for me. So yeah, our space is slightly small right now, but I feel like it's putting us in a good spot to kind of now to, like, show work in a different context and then have a new time to think of kind of our next landscape. And it's fun. It's been really fun for me to see the artists work in this space, because mm-hmm. I think it's not the white box. We have wood floors now.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and then we have these amazing huge windows that let in a lot of natural light.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of contextually changes how you look at the work a bit.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, and then just being in this neighborhood where I really do think the community, it seems like people are so supportive of each other. You go out and you have lunch and you run into people and there's bars and there's restaurants. So you're really in this place where people are supporting each other. And they go to the shows and they see the artwork and they talk to each other. And that's been really exciting for me.
Yeah.
That
sounds lovely. You know, as far as a community and whatnot, I can't help. I don't want to, you know, pee on the parade, but I do wonder, being in Bed-Stuy, you know, as your home, mm-hmm. and then thinking about the history of the Lower East Side, you know, which was very different 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, what if that's something that sort of crosses your thoughts from time to time, and like, you know, what it used to be like, you know, where it's going, you know, are you going to be priced out of Lower East Side at some point, that kind of thinking?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I didn't read this article, but I just saw a headline, something about how the Chinatown community was some backlash against the art community.
Right.
But I do think, I mean, a lot of the Chinese landlords have raised the prices. And yeah, talking about pricing out, the amount that spaces that are suitable for galleries have shot up on the Lower East Side in 2 years is crazy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be interesting to see kind of what happens. I think a lot of the prices are even close to Chelsea at this point, or, you know, they're smaller, so they're less because of that. But,
so the rent that you're paying now for your space is presumably significantly less than it would be for the same size in Chelsea. But correct me if I'm wrong, but how comfortable would you say, you know, now that you're a partner, do you feel paying that amount? Do you feel like, well, this is what you got to pay to be in this neighborhood? You know, that kind of feeling?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about spaces and sorry, I'm like, that's an obvious question, statement, but, the real estate in New York is always the problem, and you want to give your artists the best place to show work and something that they're exciting about. But at the same time, I think a lot of galleries in Lower East Side are doing amazing things with spaces that aren't that big. You know,
right.
I've seen some really amazing shows. Josh Klein's show at 47 Canal was one of the best shows I've ever seen.
Mm.
And that gallery's not huge.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
a second floor space on the Lower East Side. And so I think that's maybe another thing that people's mentalities might change about what's necessary to see art. The white cube is always going to be important, but maybe there's going to be this alternative that artists are excited to have to work around the space or figure out how to navigate something that's not this just, you know, tall walls and blank canvas.
Right. So your current space, as well as many of the spaces of your colleagues down on the Lower East Side, then could be described as having like a tour or a few different rooms, being more sort of a railroad almost kind of version of a gallery, as opposed to just like the big giant rectangle.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Got
yeah.
it. Okay, cool. Great. Well, I mean, this has been great talking to you. I don't know if there's anything that you feel like we've left out. I mean, it seems like we've covered a good amount, but I don't want to leave anything yeah. behind if you feel like we have.
No, I mean, I think that was great. I'm glad we talked about art form.
Yeah, me too. That was one of the highlights yeah. for sure. One thing, well, I'm going to put this out there. I may cut it out, but I just want to put it out there anyway. And you know, we can see if it goes anywhere. But because I feel like it would be stupid not to mention it since I was noticing it before we spoke, which is that I was looking at your artist stable and it's exactly 50-50 male-female, which, and you know,
yeah.
that's become, obviously, through various campaigns, you know, a very public issue of late. And I did want to ask or point out that when a gallery is 60, 70, 80% male, you know, that they're, mm-hmm. that certain factions of the art world are giving them a hard time, at least in social media and in campaigns. But when a gallerist, especially a male gallerist, has more of an even distribution, are they getting any credit? You know, is anybody patting them on the back?
There were some, I don't know who put it out. I think it was like even a Gorilla Girl thing recently, which there was, they broke down all these galleries, and Zach was on this, of who were showing a large number of, I'll see if I can find it and I'll send it to you.
Okay, great.
Women artists, and it broke down the percentages of different galleries. This is when we were in Chelsea, maybe about 2 years ago. So if there was that kind of acknowledgement there.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's
exactly.
Great.
I think it is good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, kudos to you and your partners for for being ahead of the curve.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I'm passionate about it, obviously, as a woman. But
right.
Yeah, I'm excited. I think there's a lot of really great women artists around right now.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Lauren, it's so great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're out. Thank you so much again to Lauren Marinaro. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Really appreciate it, Lauren. And thank you guys for listening to the show. As you know, you can support the show a number of ways. My favorite is going to theconversationpod.com/support, making a nice little donation there. I love getting those emails saying you have received a donation that come into the inbox every now and then. They're fantastic to get. Got one from Joanne Greenbaum recently. That was fantastic. You can also support the show non-financially by following on social media at Artist Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. It really helps the show if you give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Leave some nice comments by going to the iTunes page via the website, or if you're on iTunes, just type in The Conversation, An Artist Podcast, and you will find that page. Then leave a review. That'd be greatly appreciated. Also, we did hit our milestone on Facebook. We had that 1,000th like. So thank you to the dude who was the 1,000th like. I actually sent him a message saying, I think we've got your trip to St. Kitts, and I haven't heard back yet, so we're going to work that out at some point. You can still like the show, and I know that there are far, far more listeners than 1,000, just for what it's worth, and it's kind of nice to know that not all of you are on Facebook, because I don't think that's the best destination for everybody. But if you have not liked the show yet, I'm happy to have you do so there. And what else? We have some awesome episodes coming up soon. Pretty excited about the one that I'm recording next week. So cross your fingers. Hope that goes well. And you'll get to hear it soon. Thank you guys so much for listening to the show and supporting it and letting us know what you think. Definitely let us know what you think about the whole Art Forum thing. Maybe you have had an ad on Art Forum. I would very much be interested in hearing from you. And one more thing for those of you still listening at this late point in the game. The word is starting to sprout out, so I might as well be public about it. We're in the brainstorming phase of a sister podcast or another podcast that I am working on setting up. And the subject has to do with people who are just getting by financially. It can be a cool angle where they're doing all kinds of interesting gigs, or it can be a little bit more scary where they're just getting by, but anything along those lines is the kind of story that I'm looking for. I'm looking to have conversations with those people. So one of the working titles has been Eking By or Squeaking By, etc. That's still in the works. That's in the brainstorming phase. So don't hang your hat on what the title is just yet. Just focus on what the subject is. If you are that person or if you can think of somebody who you think would be good, please shoot me a message and we'll work on getting in touch with that person. All right. Thanks so much in advance. Thank you for being here. And I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.